Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. An insurrection, a riot, a threat to democracy. Tomorrow marks 1 year of a dark day cemented in our country's history. A mob of supporters of former President Donald Trump stormed the U.S. Capitol. The violence and chaos that ensued left five dead and injured 140 law enforcement officers, declared an act of terrorism by the FBI. But January 6 is far from an event in the past. There's an ongoing House committee investigation, and more broadly, that day remains at the forefront of our mind as a country, particularly how this was possible. According to a new NPR Ipsos poll, there are still deep divisions along party lines about what happened that day and why. In what has become the largest criminal investigation in American history, several hundred have since been charged in connection to January 6, including several here in the Sacramento area. But 1 year after the attack, some have asked why law enforcement in Washington, D.C. weren't better prepared. Intelligence officials did, in fact, receive tips and threats in the days leading up to January 6, alerting law enforcement agencies. So what went wrong? To better understand the complexities and the hard lessons learned, I spoke with Mike Cena, who heads the Northern California Regional Intelligence Center, among an intelligence network of 80 fusion centers that met 2 days prior to the insurrection about the threats that they were all receiving. Here's part of our conversation yesterday, walking us through those fateful days and what's changed since then. Mike, if you first can share with us your backstory, what brought you into this field and when did your career begin?
Well, I started out in law enforcement in 1993. And, you know, my focus is originally was vice and narcotics. Worked a lot of that. Started out with the California Department of Alcoholic Beverage Control. And back in 1997, moved over and was transferred to a major narcotics task force that was primarily focused on, at that time, Colombian and Mexican narcotics organizations, drug trafficking organizations. And, you know, not too long after that, when 9/11 rolled around, immediately on that day, I got a call that I was being transferred to a new organization that was being formed to kind of deal with major threats, just like what occurred on September 11th. And they didn't have a name for it at that time. But they said that the focus is going to be on information sharing, trying to address the threats as quickly as possible and improve information sharing along with criminal intelligence analysis. So that eventually became what is known as the National Network of Fusion Centers. And right now there are 80 of those centers. In California, there are 6 of them. And each center has an area of responsibility and role in information sharing to identify threats using a number of tools. And that whole organization that we have is owned and operated at the state and local level with the support of the federal government. But it really is a conglomeration of bringing together a lot of federal, state, local, tribal, territorial partners that have created this network of information sharing that we have in the country.
So with that in mind, approaching a year to the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, I mean, what comes to mind, I think, broadly is violence and chaos. But with your specific lens in law enforcement and partnering with Homeland Security, what comes to top of memory? How do you reflect on what happened last year?
Well, and many people read the Washington Post story about kind of the conversations that I was having on January 2nd with Donnell Harvin, who at that time was the director of the Fusion Center in Washington, D.C. At the NTEC. And, you know, those conversations when he called me and was describing kind of all of the online sentiment, but more than just sentiment, the people online that were talking about, you know, bringing weapons to the United States Capitol, which are prohibited, people that were threatening, you know, oftentimes implied violence. And to the point where there was enough conversations about that online that Donnell was worried. And, you know, he's one of those people that has, you know, in Washington, D.C., they have events all the time. And but it caused the, as he said, the hair on the back of his neck to stand up. And as we were talking, it was very early in the morning on a Saturday. I said, well, you know, what would you like to do? And he goes, well, I think we need to talk with all of our other fusion centers. And I said, absolutely. Whatever you want, we will do. And we actually set up a call, you know, on January 4th that Monday to talk with as many of our partners as we could. And I really expected a small number of people to show up, and then we had almost 300 people show up. And I'd asked Donnell to invite kind of his partners in Washington, D.C. to make sure that we're all on the same page about the threats that we were seeing. And ultimately, the gist of that call led me to sending out an email to a number of partners around the country about what we're going to do to try to share information more effectively. Hmm. And in retrospect, you know, on January 6th itself, obviously, you know, there was a lot of angst, a lot of disappointment, and a lot of concern about, you know, the protection of the D.C. area, and especially the facilities that were impacted are, you know, and to the threats to our members of Congress, which, you know, just like everything else we're trying to protect, protecting our legislators, protecting our institutions, protecting our processes is critical. And there was a lot of, you know, attempts to make sure that information was shared in a timely manner from our side. But once we pass information on, it's really up to the law enforcement agencies that have protection responsibility on how to, you know, use that information, that data.
We're talking about 80 fusion centers across the U.S. and U.S. territories. You said 300 people joined that call on January 4th, 2 days before. When you handed that over to Homeland Security or the FBI, what was their response?
Well, in a lot of the areas, and this is a topic that's come up, and there's been testimony about this, that from the perspective of, you know, the federal agencies, I mean, there are nuances to what they can do as well, especially with, you know, online threats that are implied. Oftentimes, you know, threats that we see online, we don't know the exact location of that threat. People don't usually post their address, and if people post their address when they post to social media, there'd be a lot less postings of social media. But we don't have oftentimes the exact address or location of folks. So when we talk about the things that the FBI or DHS may receive as far as information, they may have the information, but if it doesn't meet those federal thresholds for follow up, they really don't have the authority. And that's one of the problems that, you know, many people don't understand, is that each of the federal agencies has very specific authorities of what they can and can't do for investigations, collection of criminal intelligence, or follow-up on leads. So if it doesn't meet those thresholds, our goal is that we get that information to state and local agencies that may be able to work within the parameters of their authorities, which are oftentimes broader in the law enforcement spectrum. But ultimately, we need an address. We need some way to identify.
But were there threats that were specifically involving or mentioning the U.S. Capitol, the joint session of Congress, January 6th, and specific lawmakers?
Yeah, oftentimes, and for those that were more specific threats to individuals, if, you know, any threat that goes to an individual goes back to that agency. So if it's a threat to a member of Congress, it's the U.S. Capitol Police that have that, along with the FBI for wherever their field office location would be, or wherever they are in the country, wherever they live, along with the local agencies. So, you know, it's a multi-tiered approach to who has individual threats to members of Congress. But oftentimes, a lot of the threats that we saw were more in general, not specific to, I'm going to go out and storm the castle. It was more, I'm going to D.C., I'm going to bring weapons, and we're going to start whatever we're going to start. But not specific to a act of violence that a person was going to do, but reading into it and looking through the data, there was a lot of implications that there was something bad that was going to happen.
Given that on January 4th, just 2 days prior, you organized that conference call with regional intelligence centers, and yet 300 people join. Is that unusual?
Well, it was actually one of the first times that we've had a call like that. I mean, we actually felt like, hey, I think we're ahead of the game here. We actually have a lot of different threats that, when you bring them together, there may be, you know, something that is going to happen that we're worried about. So part of this was bringing together all these folks, but not knowing that something's going to happen. But I felt that we were a lot more ahead of the game than we have been on other threats that have been executed. So it wasn't something we normally do for these events, of bringing a call before the event. There's a lot of post calls after something bad happens, but this was one of the first times that we'd had a call beforehand where there was such an interest in the call because a number of people were seeing the same things around the country. But there were also a number of people who were on the call who didn't know that certain posts were being put out there online that involved their state or their jurisdiction. So we're able to connect those people literally on that call as we're happening, having the call, bringing those people together. So they knew that there were threats coming from someone in their state. At least it looked like they were coming from someone in their state. And that way they could dive a little deeper at the state and local level on whatever information they could dig up.
Given that on January 4th, you thought that you were all getting ahead of this. How did you absorb what unfolded on January 6th? What was going through your mind?
It was a little heartbreaking, to be honest. We never know from the intelligence side of law enforcement and how we operate. Our goal is to provide information that will hopefully get to decision makers to take whatever action they need to deal with the threats appropriately. And so, at that point, I always tell people that, no person that works in information sharing and intelligence realm is going to ever tell anybody that something's going to happen 100% of the time. There's a likelihood, and that's what we often say, is a likelihood that some type of bad things will happen. And this is why we believe this. And this is our counter hypothesis of why even our hypothesis may not be right. Trying to explain that to making sure that it gets to the right people. And oftentimes, in retrospect, some of the things that I think we've lost over the years are things like the course on criminal intelligence for the chief executive. We have had such turnover in law enforcement that I just don't feel that law enforcement in general across America from the executive level has a real understanding of how intelligence works and how to use the information that they do get, which oftentimes, and you'll hear this and have heard this probably during some of the testimony that's been provided so far, that people didn't see that as the front page item on their briefing books. And I think that that's something that obviously many of us have been trying to change over this last year to make sure that people understand how to use information and intelligence. And there actually is a national criminal intelligence sharing plan. There's a plan that's existed actually since 2003 and was updated in 2013 that unfortunately many law enforcement executives and many people in law enforcement have not read that plan.
Do you look at January 6th as a failure in response?
I do.
Or prevention?
From my perspective, I think the information sharing and intelligence was doing what it was supposed to do. It was the execution that did not go through as hard to point fingers after the fact. A lot of people are pointing fingers right now.
Yeah. What I'm hearing from you, and obviously intelligence centers and law enforcement agencies are layered and they're multifaceted. It seemed like information was going out, but obviously you have local, regional, federal, and state agencies that ultimately threats and tips and information either hit dead ends or fell through the cracks.
Well, and part of that, and I just to let you know, because everyone thinks that when you call law enforcement, that everyone in the country knows that that tip or lead came through. And there are so many silos of tips and leads. There are 18,000 law enforcement agencies out there. So many silos that, silos of excellence that people have their data in their own area, but it may not be shared. And the goal of the Network of Fusion Centers is that if a tip or lead raises to the level that you think there may be some validity to it, that you share that with the Fusion Center, and that way it can be shared nationwide. And since what happened on January 6th, we've developed dashboards, which allow us to see threats in real time across the entire country during fast moving events. It's too difficult to, keep in contact with everyone when you may have hundreds of threats that are moving at the same time. So being able to have a dashboard capability where you can see where threats are, summary of those threats, and the source of those threats allows us to better be able to connect information that was disconnected previously. Now, just because you have a whole bunch of dots on the board doesn't mean all the dots are connected. But if you don't have all the dots on the board, you can't make those connections.
Mm-hmm. What should have been done differently from when you got that call in the early morning of January 2nd to having the conference call of January 4th? What would you have wanted to be done differently?
I wish, and we didn't have it at the time, but I wish we had that dashboard capability up and running. I wish that we had, and I've mentioned this to Congress also, I wish that our technology that we currently have was modernized. We were using very old technology to communicate in a way that nobody actually really communicates anymore. So I wish we had that. The other component of that is, I wish that we had that follow-up with the executives to make sure that that they got the briefing from the people that had all the information. And I think that, you know, if we could have, you know, changed the way things happened prior to January 6th, it would have been to make sure that that analyst that had that full picture was able to directly brief each of the executives. You've got to have a good intelligence section, but you also have to be able to share information quickly. And that's the one thing that the, you know, the 9/11 Commission, you know, this idea of horizontally sharing information with all the people that have a need and right to know the information is critical. And that's something that we still stumble with across America.
In your opinion, why were local and federal law enforcement agencies in the D.C. area seemingly unprepared for the attack at the Capitol when your intelligence center, many more across the country, raised concerns days before the attacks? And as you're watching it unfold from California.
Yeah, it's difficult for me to give you an opinion and to criticize anyone for the actions that they took. You know, I will say that everyone has a piece of the problem and a piece of the solution. So I couldn't really say, you know, if this agency or that agency had done this or that differently. But I do think that if you start off with a foundation that everyone agrees that information sharing is one of the most critical things that we do to make sure that we prevent threats, that all the rest of the dominoes will fall in place. That if we make sure that, you know, individuals aren't briefed, that everyone that has a need and right to know is briefed, especially at the executive level. And this goes from the top executive to the patrol officers. Everyone has to understand what the potential threats are and how to be prepared for them. But if we have silos where people are not given the information, then we have gaps that create pockets where bad guys or individuals or groups can exploit and cause extreme harm to the public. And directly, as we saw on that day, to individuals, including the poor U.S. Capitol police officers that were barraged by, you know, by the melee weapons and the crowd that beat them, along with all the members of Congress that they were, you know, putting themselves in front of to protect them from, you know, being kidnapped, basically, from a mob of people.
Given what was in place and what existed, I know that we're talking about learning lessons from January 6th, but could January 6th have been mitigated or prevented?
You know, my belief, and that's because I'm in the world of prevention, is that every horrible event that we encounter could be prevented. Oftentimes, if we've got enough information, if we've got enough data and we've got enough analysis, if we can identify the individuals that are the threat, if we can identify the target of the threat, and we can keep the threat actor away from the you know, entity that we're trying to protect, that will reduce the threat. We can't, you know, we can't stop every threat. That's never going to happen. But I have seen it work. I've seen this work effectively, where we have seen individuals who have been unable to execute attacks because of information sharing, because we got the right people at the right time in the right place. And that's really what our role is to make sure that we get the people the data and resources that they need to intervene on threats as best we can. So could there have been done, you know, things that had been done to prevent that attack? Absolutely. But, you know, every time an attack happens, we see a buildup of infrastructure to make sure that it doesn't happen again.
Given that we're focusing and you're talking about the lessons learned from January 6th, where do you say the threat of domestic terrorism stands now? Has it increased or has it decreased since then?
I don't believe it's decreased. I think that's still one of our top threats in our country. I mean, we have seen, and, you know, after 9/11, there was a huge, you know, focus on international terrorism. But we've always had domestic terrorism as a threat to our country. we've always had individuals, whether it's far left or far right violent extremists that have gravitated towards harming, whether it's members of the government, law enforcement, the public, but people who have, been acquiring weapons or explosives and have, done major terrorist attacks around the country. But even if we look back to in my own area in Oakland, where we had a shooting of involving, and it was at a federal building where we had a individual that was actually a member of the armed forces, take a weapon and start shooting at security personnel at a federal building and causing the death of one. One of the things that I see as a major issue in America is the proliferation of privately made firearms, ghost guns. We have untraceable weapons across the country right now. A huge piece of that is in my own state of California, which has probably the largest seizures of those privately made firearms, oftentimes ghost guns in the country, where people have unserialized AR-15, like assault rifle weapons, handguns that are, people who sell those weapons or people who build them don't care if people have background checks, care if people are felons or what their intent is with those weapons. So we have a proliferation of these types of guns that are all over, flowing all over the country right now that are not traceable. We have lots of, information online for people who want to learn how to build bombs. And so we've got, just a combination of probably the worst of times where we have a large group of disgruntled people, far left, far right extremists. And, we always say, hey, we respect and we absolutely do respect First Amendment rights and people's right to privacy, civil rights and civil liberties. But when people start talking about doing violent acts, that's where we come in. And part of what we do is look for if we believe someone is talking about doing a violent act, do they have any weapons registered to them? And these days, it doesn't matter because it's so easy to get these weapons off the streets or build them yourself. If all you need is a little technology and 3D printers, and you can build your own guns. So I think that the threats have changed over the years from a focus on international terrorism. We shouldn't look away from that. We are constantly dealing with the threat from international terrorists, but we have a large group of people in the country that are willing to use violence to get their point across, whatever that point may be. And in the middle of that are a bunch of our law enforcement partners and fusion centers trying to prevent that and keep those folks from doing those threats and criminal activity. But we have people that are armed and people that are armed that shouldn't have weapons for a number of reasons, but they're building their own weapons and people are selling them across the country. And I see that as a huge threat to the nation.
That was Executive Director Mike Cena with the Northern California Regional Intelligence Center. His fusion center is among a network of 80 that received threats about January 6 in the days leading up to the insurrection and alerted law enforcement agencies. I spoke with him yesterday and he walked us through what happened from his vantage point and the lessons learned. Up next, we learn about California's 30 by 30 goal to conserve 30% of land and coastal waters by 2030. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. California's rich and diverse natural beauty has and continues to shape its identity, history, culture, and values. It's home to unique habitats and species found nowhere else on the planet. From majestic mountains to captivating coasts, unforgiving yet stunning deserts, serene forests, and wondrous wetlands. But that natural beauty is also threatened by population and a changing climate. According to the Department of the Interior, over the last 200 years, habitat loss has altered more than 75% of California's natural vegetation, including 90% of its wetlands. In the fall of 2020, the Newsom administration committed the state to a 30 by 30 goal, conserving 30% of California's land and coastal waters by the year 2030. The California Natural Resources Agency was tasked with developing a game plan for this goal and just last month released its initial draft. Here to provide details of this plan is the head of the California Natural Resources Agency, Secretary Wade Crowfoot. Welcome to Insight, Secretary Crowfoot, and thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much, Vicki. Great to be with you.
So for listeners who may not know, what exactly is the 30 by 30 plan and what are its primary objectives?
Well, as you pointed out in that really good summary, 30 by 30 refers to a target that our governor set to conserve 30% of our land and coastal waters by 2030. We have about 100 million acres of land in California. So that's conserving about 30 million acres of land in the equivalent portion of coastal waters in California. It's worth noting that this target, this goal, is really part of an international movement that's spread around the world in recent years. And it can be described as a campaign for nature, where 75 countries have actually come together and made this 30 by 30 commitment. Fairly affluent countries like France and Canada, and then countries in our global south like Costa Rica, Uganda, and Kenya. California is the first state in our nation to set this 30 by 30 goal and to hold ourselves accountable to reaching that goal in the next decade.
Your own agency, though, estimates 24% of the state's land, 16% of its coast, is already conserved. I guess why not try and conserve more than 30%?
Well, I would say a couple things. One is, you know, you did such a good job of explaining just how incredible California's nature is. And it is part of our identity, whether that's the beauty of Yosemite or Big Sur or that open space in our backyard. And it's true, California has done a good job conserving nature in many parts of our state, but we have to do more. This 30 by 30 goal is actually quite ambitious. And what it suggests or requires is that we have to expand conservation on 6 million acres of land over the next 8 years. So I'll say that our 30% target is actually quite ambitious. And then beyond that, we could potentially move further in the future.
When discussing just the historical damage done to California's biodiversity, Native American and indigenous tribes inextricably shoulder the consequences. How does this plan, this 30 by 30 conservation plan, involve tribes and even calls to restore the land taken?
Well, I think we have to recognize that California's nature has always involved people. And that has meant tribal communities have stewarded what we now know as California since time immemorial. And it's that environmental stewardship that actually have blessed us with this incredible nature that we have. For 170 years of our state's history, for the most of that, we've, as a government, fundamentally disconnected ourselves and disempowered tribal communities from actually exercising that stewardship. So 30 by 30 is an opportunity to actually change that narrative, to ensure that our history is not our future, by empowering tribal governments and tribal communities to be part of this movement. And that includes, Vicki, fulfilling the governor's policy of finding where we can return lands to tribal ownership that were former ancestral lands, and enter into co-management of our natural resources. This traditional ecological knowledge that tribes provide is absolutely essential to our movement moving forward. So we have to ensure that when we talk about improving conservation on nature, we're not separating people from nature, but we're expanding access and stewardship of people of that nature.
But when talking about stewardship in different perspectives, how involved was the public in creating these initial regional conservation proposals?
Well, I'm really proud of our team across state government that spent the last year plus listening to thousands of Californians across the state in all regions, understand what are the challenges to conserving nature, but then also what are the great opportunities. You know, California is a big place and our natural environment is really diverse. So what are our challenges and opportunities in the North Coast, for example, in Humboldt County, for example, are very different than our challenges and opportunities in Southern California. Even, Vicki, differences between what the Sacramento Valley faces versus the San Joaquin Valley. So from our perspective, 30 by 30 can't be some top-down state government initiative. What we're really trying to do is seed a movement where state government is supporting improved conservation in all parts of California.
When looking, since this plan was, and I know it's in its infancy and then this is an initial draft plan, what are the primary objectives? If you can mark some areas in our state, I mean, you talk about how diverse California is, that you're looking to preserve first. Is there actually a priority list in this?
Great question. Let me back up and explain to you, though, the three primary purposes of 30 by 30, at least the way we describe it. One is utilizing nature in the fight against climate change. You know, in California, we've done a good job in expanding renewable energy and improving energy efficiency. We've got more electric vehicles on the road than any other state. But historically, I would argue we haven't done enough to really recognize the role of nature in stabilizing our climate. We know that our plants, lands, our forests actually absorb significant amounts of carbon. And if we're going to get to that net zero carbon by mid-century, which is our target, we're going to need our lands to absorb a lot of carbon, and that requires effective stewardship. Natural areas also provide buffers from these impacts that we're facing. For example, coastal wetlands that suck up some of that sea level rise and those storm swells. So one primary purpose is really utilizing nature in the fight against climate change. The other is, as you pointed out, protecting our biodiversity. California is recognized by scientists worldwide as one of 36 biodiversity hotspots. We have a greater diversity of life, of plants and animals in California than almost anywhere else on the planet. But our growth has meant that biodiversity is stressed and under threat. We have remarkable laws to protect species when they're on the brink of extinction. Think Endangered Species Act. But it's a little bit like taking care of a patient when she enters the emergency room. You're going to keep that patient alive. But if that's the extent of your healthcare policy, it's not a very good healthcare policy. In other words, while we're going to protect species on the brink of extinction, we need to do more to keep species of plants and animals healthy so that they don't get under that acute threat. And then the third area is we need to expand access to our outdoors. You know, if COVID taught us anything, it's that Californians, people need to be outdoors for physical health, emotional and mental health. While some of us, like myself, actually can access nature pretty easily, a lot of Californians can't. There's fundamentally inequitable access to nature. So part of where we want to focus is where we can expand open spaces and nature to allow folks that don't have access to get access. So Vicky, you asked where in the state, you know, our priorities or what are our priorities? And I would say, you know, what we're not going to do is suggest that we need to focus on one area and not the other area. I'll argue that all regions of our state actually have needs to expand conservation, but also great opportunities. One of the things we're really focused on is thinking about how climate change impacts animal habitat and really understanding the connectivity of habitat that's needed given these changes in climate. Increased temperatures in a winter and summer mean that a lot of our animals that are, you know, make up our biodiversity will need to need changed habitats. And so what does that look like? So our goal is really to...
Well, I guess on that note, yeah. And looking at a region where our listeners live, the Sacramento Valley, one of the conservation challenges that you've identified is the rapid expansion of the Sac Metro and Redding communities. So I guess when honing in on these areas, what is the plan to address this specific challenge?
Effective planning. So we know that California needs more housing. We also know that we can build that housing and effectively improve environmental conservation. We've proven in California that we can protect nature, conserve nature, and grow our state. And we're going to continue to have to do that. There are counties in the Sacramento Valley, like Yolo County, like Placer County, that have done a really good job planning where their growth will occur, where their increased housing will occur, and where environmental conservation or protection needs to happen. As I said, 100 million acres of land in California. There's more than enough land to build the housing that we need to improve and expand renewable energy as we combat climate change and conserve those special areas. So I would say it's really going to hinge on effective planning in the Sacramento Valley region. I'll also say something I'm really excited about here in this valley is expanding our wetlands. You know, we've lost 95% of our historic wetlands across the Central Valley. And that's a big deal because the birds that rely on the Central Valley in this Pacific flyway need wetlands, and wetlands also provide a number of other benefits. Well, we're working with farmers, with irrigation districts, with counties to restore seasonal wetlands for the benefits of fish and wildlife, but also for agriculture and communities. So those are a couple of examples of what we need to do here in the valley.
Yeah, I mean, especially as you were talking about the San Joaquin Valley, I mean, there's unique challenges across the state, but specifically in the Central Valley, there's a tug of war of priorities between agriculture and a huge economic engine for our state, coupled with conservation. But wrapped into all of this, almost 85% of conserved lands in California are managed by the federal government. So how are they involved in this plan?
It's a great question. So, what we don't realize in the American West is the point you just made, which is much of our land is owned and managed by the federal government. So in California, that's our national forests, for example, and our areas that are controlled by the Bureau of Land Management and even our national parks. And they're an essential partner. Now, the good news is that the Biden-Harris administration has embraced this notion of 30 by 30, and they've established an initiative called America the Beautiful. They're a little less focused on the numeric target, but they are identifying how we can expand environmental conservation. The good news about that is because President Biden's leadership, we have federal agencies in California that are actively interested in partnering with us. And we think that the stars are aligned, that our success in California reaching our 30 by 30 is the federal administration's success achieving America the Beautiful. I will mention, on the topic of agriculture, it's really important to point out that when we're talking about conservation can happen on so-called working lands. For example, grazing lands for cattle. There's a great organization.
And rice farmers as well.
Rice farmers as well, absolutely. A lot of those wetlands that we talk about in the Central Valley, in the Sacramento Valley, are a partnership of rice farmers. And so what I'm really excited about is a story that's not really told is our agricultural leaders are stepping up and understanding how they can produce products to support rural livelihoods and feed America, but in a way that conserves the environment and cares for fish and wildlife. So our plan, our roadmap, does include strategies not only for conserving more areas we'd consider natural areas, but to continue to support those working lands managers that want to do both, economically produce on their land and conserve.
Before we let you go, we only have about a minute left. I'm thinking about when you're talking about accessing for historically marginalized communities that have barriers to accessing public lands, how are you going to work to offset the costs of national parks? I mean, they are expensive for a lot of families.
Absolutely. So we have to make it affordable. I'll tell you what we're doing at the state level. Right now in California, we have a state parks pass for families of fourth graders across the state to actually access our most popular parks for free. We're also engaging in a pilot where somebody can actually go check out a parks pass at their local library for free. So we know that we have to reduce the barriers to actually working class Californians accessing parks. So those are a couple of examples, but we're working on more.
And the public can provide feedback, right, of the current draft plan until January 28th?
Absolutely. By visiting californianature.ca.gov, you can get the plan and find out more about our effort. And importantly, as you said, provide feedback.
Secretary Crowfoot, thank you so much for joining us.
I appreciate the opportunity.
Wade Crowfoot is California Secretary of Natural Resources, laying out the state's 30 by 30 plan to set aside 30% of California's land and coastal regions for conservation by 2030. Still ahead, expert advice on how to get your financial well-being off to a good start in 2022. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. New year, new me. That's kind of how the saying goes, right? Or at least for some of us. But with COVID still having a grip on our lives, changing up the way we do things in the new year can be challenging. But for some people, it may be an opportunity to try something new, shake things up a bit. Yesterday, we focused on improving our mental health in 2022. Today, we're going to turn our attention to finances and some practical ways to stay in shape financially, especially as we all continue to navigate the ups and downs of the pandemic. Joining us is Tanya Hester. Tanya is the author of Wallet Activism: How to Use Every Dollar You Spend, Earn, and Save as a Force for Change, and also Work Optional: Retire Early, the Non-Penny Pinching Way. She's a former political consultant and journalist turned activist and early retiree. Tanya, welcome back to Insight.
Thanks so much for having me back.
Yeah, I was listening back to an interview on Insight January of 2020, and you were talking about retirement advice. It's now been 2 years, and obviously a lot has changed. Do you, is the advice that you offer and the tools that you offer, have they changed because of the last 2 years?
You know, I think strangely they haven't, which is odd because it feels like everything in the world has changed. But I think we've seen with the Great Resignation that even more people are interested in having control over their lives and their time and aren't willing to spend 40 years doing a career that is detrimental to their physical health, their mental health, or just feels like it's out of alignment with their ethics or values.
Right. The vast majority of Americans are carrying some kinds of debt. Are there good debt? Is there good debt versus bad debt? And if so, can you give some examples of that?
This is always going to be a contentious issue that different financial experts will have very different opinions about. But I continue to believe, as crushing as it is, that student debt is better than credit card debt, for example, because you are working toward a goal in your life or the ability to earn a better livelihood or do something that better aligns to your interests and talents. But that said, it often is so crushing for folks. And I think the student loan repayment reprieve has been a real blessing during these hard couple of years. So I hope that that gets extended further. Mortgage debt, you know, as long as it's something you can afford, that is, you know, everyone needs a place to live. I'm not in the camp of you have to buy a home. You know, certainly renting can work out really well for a lot of folks. It so depends on your particulars. And especially here in California, where real estate is so expensive, renting is the only option for a lot of folks, and that is just fine. But if you're in a position to buy and you buy a home that you can truly afford, then mortgage debt is just fine. The really bad stuff is the consumer debt, you know, the high interest debt, credit card debt, car loans that are higher interest or have a long term, things like that. I think to the extent that you can get a handle on those this year and try to pay that debt down, you'll certainly be better off in the future for it.
You know, financially, people have had hardships, and I'm saying that lightly, in the last 2 years. When you start seeing your bills add up, I mean, instead of panicking, what can someone do on a practical level to put their debt into really perspective and start taking some proactive measures to get it under control, even if they don't have a lot of money?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that's borne out in research multiple times is that the bulk of us don't actually know where all of our money is going. And I think a lot of that is deliberate, in that there's a lot of bad news in our finances and we don't necessarily want to see the whole picture. But there's tremendous value, whether you're talking about paying off debt or whether you're talking about a more lofty aspiration, like trying to align your finances to your values and your ethics, knowing where all of your money is going and where all of your money is coming from is incredibly powerful, because then it becomes easier to see, oh, I didn't realize I was spending so much on X, and maybe I can work to narrow that down so that I can funnel some of that money into debt repayment or into savings or investing goals. And it also helps you see, you know, what are the types of things you're supporting in the world. So I think for everybody, you know, getting a handle on your finances, it doesn't mean you have to do a line item budget for the rest of your life, but just knowing where your money's going, maybe for a 3-month period, will help you identify places where you might have room to pull a little bit more money aside for any of those goals, especially debt. And again, it gives you a sense of, you know, hey, I'm actually spending hundreds and hundreds of dollars a month on Amazon that I didn't realize. And maybe that's not a company you want to support anymore. And so those are only things that we can sort of realize if we get a full grasp on the full picture.
Right. Being more mindful.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for a lot of us, it's not just us. Sometimes we're financially engaged with another person, or maybe even more than one person. What are kind of some of the pitfalls of not talking about money, or talking about money in an unhealthy or toxic way?
Yeah. You know, the interesting thing is I think that a lot of couples who have challenges talking about money tend to talk about money when they really need to be talking about other things. So you'll hear the stat a lot that, you know, 50% of divorces are triggered by money stress in some way. Oftentimes that stress is really a sign of distrust or dishonesty or some other bigger issue in the relationship. And so if you find yourself in that position, trying to look a little bit deeper and honestly, a relationship therapist can be incredibly helpful for helping to figure some of this stuff out. But looking at what are you actually talking about when you're arguing about money? If it is in fact financial, something that I recommend in my first book, Work Optional, is the idea of actually throwing the money part aside. You know, sometimes you'll have a relationship where one partner is the saver and one is the spender. And the conversation will often look like the saver telling the spender to stop spending. And that doesn't usually go very well. But if instead you can put that aside and say, what is it that we want our life to look like? What are the goals we have that we want to accomplish? What are the big dreams we want to fulfill? And then if you can look at that, and again, maybe introducing the values and ethics conversation into it as well. What are the things we want our money to do in terms of sustainability in the world or in terms of making things more humane for workers? If you can have that conversation, then it becomes a lot easier to fill the money piece in behind it. And you also know what you're working toward. I think anytime you've got a big goal, if it feels like it's arbitrary, it's going to be much less motivating than if you know in your heart why you're doing it. And I think that's a key, whether it's paying off debt or saving for early retirement or any other financial goal, know your why, know what it is that life is going to look like when you get there. And I think that is much more powerful.
What do you think when it comes to investments, you know, the stock market, 401ks, where do you see the markets going this year in 2022?
Oh, gosh, I'm not going to step into that trap. People are always trying to predict
inquiring
what the markets
minds.
Are. I know. If only we all knew, that would be a wonderful thing. The stock market is always unpredictable. It should have crashed, you know, per historical norms many years ago, and it hasn't. It's continued to go gangbusters. It's gone gangbusters while people have been losing jobs and losing income. So it's really very divorced from our economic realities in many ways at this point. So maybe it'll continue to go up. Maybe it'll crash. I think anyone who's investing should always be prepared for it to crash. I think that's really important. You know, let the gains be gravy and make sure that if your investments lose 30% of their value, that you're going to be okay. You know, if you can't afford to lose that much money, then set that money aside in a savings account instead of investing it. You know, only invest the money where you can afford to lose some of it.
Before we let you go, what are some realistic expectations we can all set and accomplish in the next 12 months?
Yeah, you know, I think that sort of like physical wellness is both the physical piece of your body, your health, and the mental piece or the spiritual piece of your wellness. Financial wellness is really two pieces. It's the financial security piece and it's the spiritual alignment piece. So making sure that your money represents your values in the world. So your goal will be really contingent on your circumstances. For folks who haven't achieved financial security, maybe it's starting to save for retirement or making sure you build up your emergency fund, making a plan to tackle your debt, some of those things. I think making a plan and starting to put it in place is really good. If you're sort of onto that next level and you can think about using your money more intentionally, aligning it more spiritually for you, you can think about any number of things. You could change where you bank away from a big bank so that you're not supporting fossil fuel investments. Maybe it's changing your investments to be more aligned to environmental and social goals, choosing ESG funds. Could be changing jobs. It could be buying less. Having a plan, and I think hopefully something that I've said has lit a spark for you, follow that spark and see what feels right for you.
Thank you so much, Tanya.
Thank you for having me back.
Tanya Hester is the author of Wallet Activism, How to Use Every Dollar You Spend, Earn, and Save as a Force for Change, and Work Optional, Retire Early, the Non-Penny-Pinching Way. That's it for Insight today. But before we go, we do have a quick programming note to pass along. Tomorrow, in place of Insight, NPR will provide live coverage of the January 6th insurrection. We will, however, be interviewing Sacramento Unified School District Superintendent Jorge Aguilar about how the district is handling the COVID surge. And we're going to post that interview on our website, and it will be available on the Insight podcast. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here on Monday.